This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Happy New Year, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. Can you believe it's 2016 already? Man, that is just blowing my mind. We're starting the new year with a great episode. I sit down with my friend Jason Butler of Let Live. And if you guys haven't seen Let Live, you have to check them out. Now, basically the whole thing about them is that Jason is one of the most intense, crazy performers you'll have ever seen. I've seen him jump off speaker stacks. I've seen him climb a balcony at the House of Blues. I've seen him run off the stage and come back with flowers he picked and give them to a girl. I've seen him do it all and more. And so we talk a lot about that at the end of the episode. We talk about his recent marriage to another lead singer, Jin Wigmore, which is always very interesting to talk about. We talk about the last record, Black is Beautiful, not quite being what some of the fans wanted. And of course, we talk about the new record, and we get into all kinds of other awesome stuff. So since it's the new year, I wanted to talk about New Year's resolutions a little bit. In the past, I've made a few, and most of them have failed epically. But I was actually reading a statistic that apparently you are 10 times more likely to succeed doing something at the beginning of the year than if you just randomly did it on, you know, June 30th or whatever. So I'm attempting a few New Year's resolutions myself. If you guys have any, I'd love to hear yours too. Email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. But a couple things I'm trying to do. The first thing, I'm going to go for a sober month of January. And we'll see. I think this podcast can help because every week I'll check in about it and see how it's going. So I'm trying to go 4 weeks, no drinking alcohol at all, not even wine with dinner. So we're going to see how that goes. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm really going to make an attempt to get in better shape. So I got the P90X DVDs ready. I've got my personal trainer on the phone. I'm going to give him a call. We're going to meet up for some intense sessions. So finally, I think 2016 is the year that I don't slack. And maybe not drinking will help with that as well. So those are my New Year's resolutions. And if you have any, please email me. I would love to hear them. So now with 2015 under our belts, 2016 is going to be a huge year for the show. We have so many great guests confirmed. It's going to be awesome. And I'm really excited at just how everyone's reaction has been to the podcast. And everyone's been so positive and so loving to me. And I just want everyone to know that 2016 is going to be a huge year for this, and thank you so much for the support. And it really warms my heart how many people have asked, what can I do, Shane? What can I do to contribute to the podcast? Is there a PayPal link? And basically, we're working on all that right now. We're hoping to have a really, really cool kind of like VIP club set up where you can get exclusive content. You know, you can have more interaction with me, ideas for the show. I mean, even if you want to come on a podcast and co-host with me, we're going to try to make these options available. So for now, just give us a little bit of time to work that out. But one thing you can do to help is if you're going to buy anything on Amazon, just use our Amazon referral link. Again, the show gets 4% of whatever you buy, and it costs you absolutely nothing. So just go on to leadsingersyndrome.com/Amazon. It'll take you right to the Amazon website, and whatever you buy, 4% straight to the show. I know a lot of people buy like all their household goods and diapers and everything on Amazon. So please, if you don't mind, you know, throwing us a bone, that would really help us with some of the costs associated with the show. And some Silverstein news. My band is going on tour across Canada. And also in the U.S., we're playing, you know, what they call B markets, some of the smaller cities. We're going out with Being as an Ocean, awesome band. Also Amorosa, who are totally, totally amazing. It's going to be fantastic. So please check out silverstein.soundrink.com. We got VIP packages up there if you want to hang out. They got regular ticket links too. And that's starting at the end of February. and it should be an amazing tour. And also, I'll address a few rumors. If you've been listening to the podcast, I did an episode with Soupy from the Wonder Years, and we talk about how I, you know, played his show solo. So a lot of people have been talking about, oh, Shane, you're doing a solo project. And yes, I am. And yes, it is coming very soon. So if you want to hear more information about that, tune in next week. I'll have more information, maybe even the name of the project. Who knows? But it's coming very soon. So stay tuned. This podcast will be the first place I announce anything. So I know you will listen every week, and I know you guys have already subscribed. If you're listening on SoundCloud or something, no. Go subscribe using whatever podcast app it is, whether it's just the one on your iPhone, whether it's Stitcher, Overcast, whatever it is. Please hit the subscribe button. And while you're at it, go on iTunes. Please rate the podcast too, because that really, really helps. Anyways, let's jump in to my discussion with Jason Alon Butler of the fantastic band Let Live. When only the good time, you're good to talk to you, man.
Yeah, man, seriously, yeah. Didn't you guys just wrap up a tour a little while ago?
We were just in Europe. We were in like Russia, and we went to some crazy places.
Like, awesome.
It was totally nuts. Have you guys been to Russia before?
No, we were gonna go last year, but we didn't. I wish we had, but yeah.
Yeah, man, it's a crazy place. Like, you know, they don't get a lot of shows there. So it's one of those places where kids just like, it's like they've only ever seen shows on like crazy DVDs of like, I don't know, like the fucking Stooges playing or something, you know, and they just think that's what they're supposed to do. And I love that, man. I'm
so
all
cool.
About like
so
that,
wilding
that
out.
Vibe.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah, really.
Man. Yeah. And so you guys are out with Rise Against right now, right?
Yeah. Rising Against and Killswitch at the moment.
And it's the longest tour ever?
No, man. We did the first one in the summer, which was rad. And then we like took the break, and then we do this one, which is basically like secondary and tertiary markets that we didn't do on the first one. So it's been good.
Cool.
Yeah, it's been good.
Awesome. Yeah. And I kind of wondered about that tour, like the bands, because it's Rise Against and it's Killswitch. And I don't know, was there any hesitation with you guys like doing the tour? Your music is so diverse and you have so much stuff going on in it. Like, where you don't really sound like any other bands.
Yeah.
It's difficult. It must be hard to find a tour where you really feel like you fit in.
Yeah. You know, that was kind of, I think initially when we first started touring, I think that was probably the hardest part for us. And then we had to start to learn that we needed to just start touring with bands that we liked, like music that we liked, not necessarily maybe music that we were directly linked to sonically. So we started just getting tour offers from bands we liked, anything from like Buck Under Oath to, you know, Deftones to you guys, you know what I mean? Like things like that.
Sure.
We got like offers like that for music that we enjoyed. So I think that was kind of what helps guide our decision, as opposed to trying to make it a more sonically aligned movement most of the time.
Absolutely, you know, it's tough, but I mean, it's cool, I guess, because you have like, if it was just you guys and Rise Against in there, and there was like another punk band, maybe you guys would feel a little bit more. But you have like another heavy band with Killswitch, So you guys are kind of like somewhere in the middle there, right? Like,
yeah, I think we exist. Yeah, we exist somewhere in that limbo.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool, dude. So this is the first time on the show. I don't know if you know much about the podcast. It's called Lead Singer Syndrome.
Yeah.
Basically, I interview a bunch of other lead singers about, like, you know, lead singer stuff. Like, So one question I like to ask people is, especially when they're on tour, how much gear did you carry today?
Shit. Well, we haven't loaded yet, but I have been known to pick up, you know, a pedal board or two. You know, you know, I think
maybe even at the same time, one in each hand.
Dude, sometimes I'll take, dude, the other day in Rochester, New York, I took one guitar case in my left hand and two guitar cases in my right hand, which seemed to be more.
Wow, you must have very manly hands.
You know, I've been able to extend them into what people may think are manly, but, you know, I'm just really playing the guy, you know, playing the part. So, yeah.
That's great. And how's your voice feeling on tour?
It's good, man. Like, it's actually the first time in about 2 years that we're in a van again.
Yeah,
we feel
yeah.
like the tour is short enough and the distance between shows are short enough for us to do that. And also, like, financially, it'll really benefit us in the end if we just took a van and we figured we just do it like we used to. And what's the term? Tough it out?
Absolutely. There are some benefits to touring in a van over over a bus or a bandwagon, which you guys have been doing for years. We've only done a van, like in the last few years, only like for maybe a week show at the most or something.
But
one thing that I really like about riding the van is just how you share music with people. Because, you know, I still listen to music a lot on tour, but it's always just like I'm listening to headphones in my bunk or whatever.
True. Yeah.
And I love the fact when you're driving around like in a van, it's like, hey, check out this record like I heard, and, you know, someone in your band. So you actually share music.
Yeah.
Is there any other benefits you're finding to being back in a van?
I mean, we get to share a lot of space with each other. That's one thing we're sharing. But I'd say like essentially that is it. It's forcing us to be, not that we're not generally, but it's even more so, more social, more interactive with each other. A little more considerate of each other because we're in closer quarters. But I also like that we can decide to go to some sort of maybe like a site or just drive off of whatever itinerary path we've been on and take the van and trailer somewhere as opposed to a bus or bandwagon where it's much more difficult to find parking or even to fit in some of these places that we're trying to go use. So you're kind of on your own.
There's nothing worse than feeling like you're stuck in some venue. Venues, let's be honest, are in some shitty fucking parking lot somewhere.
Absolutely.
And there's like nothing around and, so it is nice. Yeah, absolutely, man. That's great. So, well, it's the first time on the show. I kind of want to dig deep and I really want to talk about, your start in music and how you became, this dynamic lead singer that you are, for such a great fucking band. And, I know you're from Los Angeles. I know, you had kind of a rough upbringing from what I understand. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and, we can dive into, how you kind of became where you are now.
I mean, I guess essentially it was just, when I was younger, my father was, a musician and, he was a musician before I was born and he continued to be, to this day, he's still playing live gigs. So my idea as far as like, an occupation of sorts or, what you did as a man, as exhibited by my father was you're an entertainer, you play music. And I just thought it was so cool. Him and his friends were always just so cool. They were just like dudes that were by the way of what they wanted to do and how they wanted to do it. And there was always this sort of like, this sort of aberrant, this sort of uniqueness about each one of the members of his band. Even if they seemed to be like guys who had just gotten off an accounting job or, working at an auto shop, like they'd come and as soon as they were in that room being artists, they were different. And I always found that really attractive. So, that was my musical nexus was my father and his bands. And then of course all the music they were playing and my mother playing all this music throughout the house, whether she was just cleaning or just hanging out. And I guess the disparity between what my mother and father were listening to was pretty expansive, like pretty large differences between them. But, they were examples to me. Like, that's what I liked. And then growing up in, I grew up in Inglewood and in Inglewood, like punk rock and skateboarding and that sort of counterculture were not, they were not at all prevalent. And,
they weren't prevalent. Okay.
No, not in the beginning. It was more so like I played basketball and I ran around the streets and I caused trouble with my friends, that's what we did. In my earliest like memories are just me running out with friends, being kind of like dickheads, but,
I mean, maybe I'm way off base here, but I picture like, this is the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And you're in, like the ghetto in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Like I picture like Boys in the Hood type of shit.
Yeah.
That scene when I can't remember if it's Boys in the Hood or if it's Menace to Society when like those kids are like walking and then the like older kind of, main character's like, yo, throw me that football. And the kids are like, no, don't throw him the football. He's just going to take it.
Yeah.
And like that kind of like maybe I'm way off base. I know that's a fucking movie and in a totally, dramatizing what it is, but I kind of wonder how much of that was real to your upbringing?
Oh, no, it was very, I mean, it was very much a pretty authentic representation of the time, especially in the 90s. I mean, we were experiencing everything from, like, you know, this new sense of racial division with, you know, the prison industrial complex, and then people getting let back into the hood, essentially, after serving time.
Yeah.
To the war, drugs being an extremely concentrated effort in literally my area, like Inglewood, Compton, Watts, you know, all that area, Hawthorne, like, you know, we experienced all that, Lenox, like, that was all very, very concentrated in our area. So, no, those movies were pretty accurate, actually. And for me, you know, I was, my father and my mother always stressed the idea of, I'm sorry, stressed the elements of education. And so I read a lot, and my dad used to come home from work because he was, because once I was born, he had to get a real job because my mom didn't want him touring anymore, you know. So he was an accountant. He would make up all these math problems at work, and he would make a times table, you know, laminated sheet, and I would have to study if I wanted to go out and play ball or if I wanted to go see my friends. So before I got to do all that, you know, sort of juvenile bad shit, you know, I had to read and I had to learn. And so there was a very big stress on that. And much like Boys in the Hood, you know, like our main character, was it Robert Downey? Cuba Gooding, Robert Downey. Cuba Gooding,
yeah. He did play a black guy in a movie once.
He did, yeah, he did. I get them confused all the time, very similar. But yeah, like, just like, much similar, I would say more similar to that than, say, you know, the gangsters in anything like CB40 or like, or Menace of Society. Like, I was more inclined to, you know something and then fight for it, as opposed to just, you know, going out and whooping people's asses, like, and being part of a gang. It wasn't necessarily my thing, but I did, in fact, learn a lot about, you know, I guess, classism. I learned a lot about that when I found punk rock, you know, because as much as I love, I mean, I adore and I subscribe to punk rock, like, it also showed me that there was this other world, not only being subversive, but, like, the people that I knew that were being subversive were, like, I didn't know why they were doing it. You know what I mean? I was like, well, you come from, like, this nice area, and you have this this image that provides you some sort of privilege and, and these things. Yeah. You know, and I did not quite understand it, so as I dove deeper into punk rock, you know, coming from a more adverse and marginalized background, I started to realize that it was more so a frame of mind. And that frame of mind really did, it did line up with what I used to think when I was, you know, back at home in the hood. Like, I just thought about, you know, what it would be like to change things. Why is this way, and how can it be different? And I think a lot of those same themes run and braid themselves throughout, you know, hip hop and you know, a lot of disenfranchised cultures and punk rock. And so, you know, as I got older, I learned a lot about that.
Well, I mean, you know, you easily could have fallen into the trap. I'm sure you have friends that you grew up with that went, you know, got into trouble with drugs and you know, committing crimes or whatever.
Yeah.
And I mean, you didn't, you know, you're here and you are traveling the world and you're in a very, you know, successful band. You know, so I guess you would attribute that to, you know, your father putting, like, pressure on you to read and learn. And also, you know, you mentioned the discovery of punk rock. And I'm wondering how that happened. How did you discover punk rock? I mean, I think of, you know, Southern California, I guess you have this, like, I think of that time. I think of, like, Hermosa Beach. I think of, like, you know, Pennywise and that whole scene. And then there's, you know, Bad Religion. There's all that happening. But I don't know how easy it is, you know, as a kid in Inglewood to find out about that, you know? And I'm kind of wondering your story on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, essentially, so, you know, back focusing again on the idea of education, my mother, she used a friend, like a friend in the area adjacent to ours, like Westchester, like Los Angeles, another suburb. She used their address to get me into a school outside of Inglewood because she felt as though that system was drowned by a lot of inconsideration by the district in Inglewood.
Yeah.
And so she went ahead and basically lied to get me on to get me into these schools at a younger age. So when I was 10, I started going to schools in Westchester, and that area in Westchester, we shared a lot of, I mean, like I said, it was adjacent to Inglewood, but again, the difference in culture was quite ostensible, and it was pretty glaring. But the education that I began with and when I started to really get nurtured by, you know, by that whole, I guess, school system, which I now think has a lot of flaws, but
sure, of course.
Was when I was 10 years old, you know, and I went to school with a fake address, and then when I went to high school, middle school and high school, I was on a permit, it was called a permit, so you apply to go to this area and you get bussed in from your area. That's what they would call it. You get bussed in and you would see us, you know, a bunch of folks like myself, primarily Black Latino folk getting bussed in to middle and high school. And so when I went to those high schools, clearly I was integrated with people from the other areas, and they were all talking about this thing, you know, skateboarding and rollerblading and surfing. and I think I've just always had some sort of inherent penchant for, things that seem a little dangerous and exciting, I'm sure I've kind of exhibited in my stage sense.
I think
of self.
The people have noticed, yes. I have noticed. Yeah. We're gonna talk a lot about that. I got a lot of questions for you.
Cool. Yeah, so I mean, yeah, I think that with when I went to school over there with this sort of new friend that I had found in skateboarding was through that, was coming to this next area, and it was such a influential thing for all these people because they were from those areas. You know, they were from the Hermosa Beaches or like not too far, like the Playa del Rey, like the, you know, those areas where skateboarding was a thing and surfing was a thing. And it was just really interesting. I can't like pinpoint what it was. It just intrigued me. And then I did it. And that's literally all my skate 411 video mag, right, the Trans World videos, you know, all that shit. Like the old
the
Bones Brigade
video, Welcome to Hell,
Misled Youth,
absolutely.
You know? Yeah. Like the Shorties video, like all this shit. But what really turned me on to punk rock was, this old Bones Brigade video, and it had, you know, it had your Lance Mountain and Steve Cab like skating. Mm-hmm. They were skating over this couch, and they were playing The Faction, and I was like, whoa, this is cool. Like, I want to check this out. And I checked out The Faction, and from The Faction, I broke off to learning that, you know, there were bands like from my area or like my relative area. There was Black Flag, there was Circle Jerks, you know, like there were all these Angry Samoans. There were these bands from my area that did this music. And with that, I started to learn about, you know, not only the music was exciting, and it was like a really big, like, fuck you to what was going on, which I also, at a rebellious age, you know, anywhere from like 11 to, fuck, I don't know, early 20s, you know, like, you want things that seem like they're subverting, you know, what the normative expectation of what you should listen to and what you should be, and that's what punk rock was to me. So I guess...
So how did you find these records? Like, I mean, you know, a lot of people listening... They don't, it's hard, like, especially younger people, they don't understand, like, you couldn't just fucking Google it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
there was
no
internet. So you had to find out, like, you had to find, someone had to hand you a flyer, or you had to have a friend give you a record, or you had, you know. Do you remember, like, your first punk show or anything?
Yeah, oh, dude, absolutely. My first punk show was Less Than Jake, actually, when I was, like, I was 12, and I went to Less Than Jake and Anti-Flag, actually. Were the first two bands that I saw that were like a punk, you know, that punk vibe. And then very shortly after, I started going to shows at home, near my home in Inglewood, because I started to realize that there were bands doing this locally. And I found this out, and this is to all the kids that, you know, wouldn't believe that there was something before Google or Spotify or iTunes Music or whatever, Apple Music.
Yeah.
I had an older friend who was, he was a skateboarder, and he used to take me around to skate because I could hold my own with like the older guys. I was like really, really into skateboarding. So I rolled with them, and he was listening to, what was it? Minor Threat. He was listening to Minor Threat, and it just completely changed my world. Like, well, I was like, what? This guy is so staunch and earnest, and he's like, he believes in something, and he was explaining to me what straight edge was and all these different things. And the way I got it was through friends at the time. They were older, but then we started going to shows, and then we would see people wearing different t-shirts, and I mean, I'm going to be straight. I'm going to be totally honest. The ones with the most aesthetically pleasing design is like what I wanted to look for. You know, like, I was super into Crass because I just thought the anarcho-punk aesthetic was amazing at first. And then I realized that it was just fucking cool. I really liked Doom. I really liked, you know, Disrupt. I was just, you know, all these different things. Like, I remember getting or seeing like a Police Bastard shirt from Doom and just being like, oh my God, like, they have, I know that they're antithetical to fascism and you know, the Nazi regime, but they, but the fact that they were so bold enough to like show the swastika on a shirt in order to go against it was insane to me, you know? And, you know, and then Dead Kennedys, obviously, you know, and Bad Brains. Okay, so Dead Kennedys, Bad Brains, Fishbone for me. Oh, and, you know, that was like a huge thing, like that was a huge representation because, I was the black kid in punk. Like, there were no other, like, in my area at least, there were no other black kids except for me and my friend Randall, who is, like, clearly black. Like, he's
I know Randall,
Yeah, you know Randall, yeah. So it was me and Randall as kids in middle school. We were the only black kids. And then we had a couple Latino friends that were into punk, and we would go to shows, but we were the only people of color. So for us, the range of representation was rather small at the time when we were younger. So Bad Brains, Fishbone, Dead Kennedys, you know, they had people of color in their band, and I was like, well, cool.
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, my best friend in high school was also a half black kid.
Yeah.
And his favorite band was Fishbone as well.
Yeah.
And the amount of Fishbone shows and records I listened to, he put on all the time because it was his favorite band. You know, like Angela was like his fucking hero.
Dude,
you know?
That's so dope.
And,
cool.
And he was and it was the same. He loved those bands, and you know, and he loved like he even loved some metal bands, and I think you know like he loved like Living Color.
Yeah,
he loved
absolutely.
And I mean, and he loved Body Count too.
Yeah.
He loved like I think it was is it Norwood Fisher? Is that the bass player's name?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was a bass player too, and he just like idolized that dude. So
that's
I mean,
so
and
cool.
it was weird because I grew up in a very very white town. Like,
yeah,
I think my high school had like maybe like less than 20 black kids, I'd say.
Yeah,
and so you know, so I guess him being like immersed in that, like because we were all punk rock kids, right? But then he found his identity, I guess, through himself, through these bands. I guess that's kind of like what you went through.
Mm-hmm. Oh, most certainly. I mean, to be honest, because, okay, so I grew up, my father, obviously, I grew up on soul and R&B and, like, that kind of, like, my father, like, he called himself the rock and roll gangster, you know what I'm saying? Like, so that was, like, my shit, you know, Prince and James Brown right. And Marvin Gaye and, like, that was my shit, you know, Tower of Power, Earth, Wind & Fire, all that. And then I got hip-hop because my half-brother, but, you know, is my brother, he showed me, dude, I remember when he showed me, The Chronic. I remember when he showed me Doggy Style. I was damn, like, this shit is like, it's really like, I don't even get these statements he's making about women. I don't get what he's talking about with the drugs. I don't get that, but there's something about this swagger, you know? So for me, that was mm-hmm. like the beginning. And then so when I went into punk rock and seeing that it was rather, you know, it was pretty vanilla, for lack of a better term. I wish I could finesse
yeah.
that better.
Yeah.
It was a pretty vanilla sort of music culture. And then as I started to go deeper and deeper, I learned that it was not, it wasn't as vanilla as I thought, you know, and those are the bands that really did help me feel comfortable and feel a sense of or place in the punk rock culture.
Absolutely, dude. No, yeah. That's awesome, man. So I want to talk a little bit about your vocal style. I mean, you know, your dad, I mean, you still haven't really described his music. I'm trying to think about it in my head, like what it kind of sounds like. I'm picturing like a funk. I'm picturing like an 80s kind of funk thing, but like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Like, can you describe, is there any bands that his music sounded like?
Yeah, I think my father, a lot of like, I'd say Tower of Power, kind of Earth, Wind & Fire-y
okay, yeah.
kind of stuff. But like so my dad was like, you know, 70, you know, 77. My dad released this record called Cream City, and it was touted as like this really pretty seminal record, and they like some people saying it was like you know, on the heels of Prince and all this other stuff, and who, you know, artists of which my father toured with, you know, and before that he was in Little Richard's band. My dad played guitar in Little Richard's band. So like, you know, he's done it, you know, he went out and did it. And so I would say his music is like that, but he played guitar, you know what I'm saying? He played guitar. So it was like at the time, it's, you know, in the later 70s and you come into Hollywood from Milwaukee, which is what he did with his boys, you know, you're intrigued by rock and roll. So, I mean, I think there's elements of rock, but you know, more so I'd say like a soulful R&B kind of rock thing that my dad had going on.
So I guess the soul punk moniker you guys have kind of given yourself, I guess, kind of comes from that. Your upbringing, you know, bass, and then all the punk rock bands you mentioned. But I mean, your music is so diverse. Like, I wonder when you guys write a song, you know, and like the other dudes kind of come up with the bulk of the instrumentation, I assume. And then it's your job to be like, okay, what am I going to do on this?
For you,
it's like you can fucking sing, you can scream, like you can kind of rap over stuff. Like, I don't even know. Like, it must be difficult for you to be like, okay, what am I vibing here? Like, what am I going to do? Is that tough for you?
Well, a lot of it, I grew up playing guitar and bass and drums. So like, I usually write a lot of the music, and then I'll put vocals to it, or vice versa. I'll have a vocal, and then I'll write music to it, and then I bring it to the band, and then that's when we decorate it. But I wanted to be a songwriter my whole life. So like, as a kid, I made sure that I practiced every instrument possible, you know. So by no means am I like a multi instrumentalist, like by trade or something. I can play different instruments, and so I usually write stuff. For the most part, I'll write my songs like by myself, and then I'll bring it into the band, and then we make it let live, you know, like, you know, Jeff will take in and write his own part, RJ writes, you know, and then, or if they write something first, I'll just have to sit with it, man. I you know, sometimes I can do it immediately. Sometimes like, I'll just start, you know, vibing over it, scatting over it, and it's great, and it's what ends up on the record. But then sometimes it's like, I'm not hearing this song like the way that it wants to be sung. Sometimes I just need
can relate to that. There's, you know, songs, I mean? There's some great songs that'll come to you in like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And there's some songs that'll come to you in like 5 months.
Exactly, dude. Like, that's exactly with this last record too. Like, so, I wrote a bunch of stuff for this record, and at first I think the band thought I was like crazy. They were like, what are you doing? Like, cause I wrote it all. I'm just, you know, I taught myself how to use Pro Tools recently, and then I was writing a lot of stuff. You know, I was programming stuff, and I was, you know, playing, bass and guitar and keys, and but I was doing it all like, cause I'm so into obviously like idiosyncratic kind of like hip hop and R&B and that creepy R&B and shit. So I was writing it with like heavy synth and crazy atmosphere, and I bring it to the band, they're like, all right, I got this, and I got this vocal for this. And they're like, we don't know, like, how are we supposed to texturize this? So it took us a minute to figure it for the new record, to kind of figure out how we were going to make these songs that in my head, you know, were coming out as like this kind of like, this strange, mutation of what Let Live is, and how we're going to make it seem like a Let Live song. And,
right.
We took a
but
few,
the problem that, Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say we just took a few months, but we did it. You know, we did it. Just took time.
Well, it's really funny when you have like when you do that, because I'm the same way, and I you know, I play guitar and drums and bass myself too, and I'll write like a whole song and bring it to the band just like you described. And sometimes if I use like a drum kit on Logic or GarageBand that doesn't quite sound right, it sounds like dancey a little bit, or if like the bass tone I'm using, because like I did a bunch of demos, I don't actually have a bass, so I just programmed it like using MIDI, and it's funny how when you play that for somebody, they like, you can wrap your head around, it's like, oh no, it's going to be real drums and it's going to be real bass, and then that keyboard part is actually going to be like a lead guitar, like with, you know, distortion. So just like, but you can't put that in someone else's head.
You can't expect
them to hear that. So like, I've really freaked out some people in my time doing that.
Absolutely, dude. Yeah, that's exactly what happened here. So we had to just try it. You know, it was like, I was like trying to explain it. So I was like, all right, we just got to play it. Like, we just can't, you know? And so I think us as singers, we have to realize that we're creating a foundation for ourselves, and you know, that's good to follow, but you know, I guess it's sort of letting go of the reins a little bit and being like, okay, like, just, you know, put your touch on this, and just, I guess, keep the integrity of the song and go for it. So
how much does your band trust you, like, with that stuff? Like, you know, I always wonder, because my band, I have full trust from everybody. Like, when I do my vocals and stuff, no one's even at the studio, you
That's
know,
all.
Like, they aren't really, like, they don't read my lyrics or anything. They're just like, and I kind of wonder how that is with you guys.
Yeah, I think they trust me. I mean, I think when I brought these songs, I think they were really tripped out. I think they thought I was trying to, like, turn into, like, fucking, I don't know, like Body Count or something. Or, like, like, I think they thought I was trying
evil
to go
Dick?
From...
Was there an yeah, Evil yeah, Dick yeah. reference?
Yeah, yeah, totally. But, you know, I think that we got past that. And for the most part, like, every record I've recorded by my, like, vocals by myself, and I'll do some post-production yeah. stuff by myself. Like, with this last record, I worked with a composer, so I wrote some stuff on piano, and then he basically translated it and then basically beefed it up in a quartet arrangement. I have a composer friend who works for, like a real, he works for movies and television, and so I did that post-record, you know, and I did that on my own, and I made everyone aware, and, you know, while I was doing it, and then I mean, it came out great, I think, not because of me, but more so because of, like, the help with my friends. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think they trust. And I mean, I know that there are yeah. things people want, and they want to hear from, you know, certain elements of the band, whether it be me or whatever. But, yeah, I think so. I mean, this is the first time ever that I had people in the studio while I was recording vocals. And admittedly, at times I didn't like it because I don't like to feel like I am not completely within myself, you know, so that I can give the best performance of a, you know, emotionally and also, but also, like, you know, critically, like I want to give, technically, I want to give the best performance. So
sure. Yeah.
This is the first time I had people in the studio, and I'm going to be honest. There was times where I had to be like, yo, get out, you know, like, just cause they're, you know, I sometimes feel the need to just completely act as if I'm in the scenario that I'm singing about and not in a studio singing about a scenario, if that makes sense.
I totally get that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a difference. There's a big difference, like when someone's recording a guitar or a bass or drums or something, right? It's like there isn't the same emotional connection to a performance.
Yeah,
especially with
yeah.
a guitar, when you're spending, like, so much of the guitar, you're just like, all right, is it in tune? Does it sound mm-hmm. okay? All right,
yeah.
now let's just get all the notes, like, in the right timing, you know?
Totally.
And then there isn't
totally.
A lot of, like, you know, the finesse between notes and stuff with guitar playing isn't nearly the same as when you're like, I'm in a fucking vocal booth, and, like, for me, I gotta, like, turn the lights down, I gotta get
yeah.
like, the right fucking mood, you know?
Totally.
And then I have to think about every note and what I'm saying, and then it's really is bad when it's like, when someone's like, yeah, no, that wasn't it. It's like, oh, I know that wasn't it.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I'm just,
yeah.
let me get to where I need to get.
Exactly. It's a very, very, very fragile place to be in. And I completely agree. Yeah. Like with this, when we were doing the record, I had these giant blackout curtains in the vocal booth. So it felt like I was alone.
Yeah.
The only reason I knew anyone was there is because the engineer would, like, talk back to me. My headphones, like, but
yeah, and then you hear, like, people in the background telling dick jokes or something.
Yeah,
like, fuck,
exactly.
Shut up.
It really, like, throws you somewhere else. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
The last record, I mean, a lot of people were really kind of thrown for a loop with the production.
Yeah,
because, you know, you guys really went for, like, a really fucking raw record.
Yeah.
Do you guys regret that decision at all, or you guys totally stand by it?
Nah, I totally stand by it. Only because.
Okay.
We are unable to route your call. Please try your
Hello?
Call again. This.
Sorry, but I'm not sure what happened there.
Yeah, that was super weird. My phone started ringing. Like, while I was on the phone with you, it started ringing. I'm like, that's fucking weird.
Oh, weird.
But yeah, yeah. And then you were gone. But anyways, yeah, let's get back to Black's Beautiful. And I guess the question I had was, the direction of the production really threw some people for a loop, and you guys have any regrets about taking that direction with the production on that album?
Yeah, I really don't. And that's a good, the cool question, or I'm sorry, the coolest element of that question is, like, through the years, I've had to go back and listen and try to figure out what it was that, you know, made it seem as though we didn't give a fuck about the production. And then I started to become more objective as you get older, more mature. Also just, you know, just more, I guess just a better artist, you know, I'm able to sort of, look outside of myself. So I guess I was more objective and I started to see it. I started to see why. I'm like, okay, cool. I get it. I totally get it. But as far as what we were trying to accomplish at the time, I don't regret it, because at the time I know that I was personally sick, just sick of hearing records that you could not tell the difference between. Like three producers were producing about every, three producers were engineering, producing, and mixing, like, you know, every other record in our quote unquote scene, and being so closely linked to all of these bands. I personally, again, I don't want to speak completely on behalf of the band, but for the most part, this is how we all felt. Felt as though it was just becoming so homogenized. It was just so. It was an annoyance to me, to be honest. So
yeah,
we, in some, I guess it was a bit selfish, but at the same time, like, you're an artist, like you can be selfish sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, and we wrote a record that kind of combated that, that opposed that sound. And not to mention, like, we also, when we did it, we didn't hit the mark. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not going to be like, it's exactly what I want the record to sound like, because it's not. It's definitely not what I wanted the record to sound like, exactly. But what we did, what we tried to achieve, I think for the most part, was achieved as far as the essence. And that was just like presenting the songs to sound as they did while we were recording them, when we wrote them. And not really giving them that extremely over-the-top or zealous attention in mixing and all the post-production of the record. Yeah. Again, like I said, it's not exactly what in my head or any of our heads we heard. It's not like that wasn't what we thought we were going to put out. But the idea and what we were trying to do, we certainly don't. I would never. I don't want to apologize for it. You know what I mean? Like, because people that enjoyed it, they enjoyed it on another level, and that's really cool too. But it also would. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Finish up. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but it also. In some strange sort of roundabout way, sets us up to put out a record with really awesome mixing on this in production. And it will really sort of, I think it'll amplify and enhance the disparity will make it seem like we just really put our best foot forward. And we let go of our gripes with the current state of music, and we just made a good record on this record, you know.
I totally get that. But you know, with your band, I mean, I first heard of you guys, I saw you live. Like, I had never heard your recordings before.
Yeah.
So, you know, I heard, you know, you guys play, and I was like, oh, this is fucking awesome. And I went back and I listened to Fake History, I guess was the record that you'd put out.
Yeah.
And for me, I thought you guys were better live than on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought there was a vibe, there was a certain energy that you guys had in your live show. And I'm not just talking about like you running around. I'm talking about like the actual music.
Yeah,
and the way
I agree.
It came out of the speakers was not the same way that it came out of like my car stereo when it was recorded. So I totally
agree.
Understand why you guys made that decision for the follow-up to go that route.
Yeah.
But I guess you were about to talk about the new record, which, is it finished?
Yeah, it's all done. We're actually in the latter portion of mixing, so we should be done like within the
cool.
week. Yeah.
And the title is If I'm the Devil, is that right?
Yeah, I guess I wasn't supposed to say that, but yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll cut it out. I'll put a big beep over when I say it.
I like that.
That'll
cool.
be funny. So it's called beep.
No,
that's awesome. We won't reveal the title as of yet, unless of course when the podcast comes out, it's already out. Then
totally.
Fuck you, man.
Yeah, fuck
but,
everybody.
Great. So tell us about the record if you can, whatever you can reveal.
Well, I mean the overarching theme for this record is a very like personally aware perception of you know, our political state. as well as our emotional state as a result of that. You know, I guess it's more so like this oppressive force that we've always known has been there, especially being from this world that is punk rock or alternative music. Like, we've always known that it's there. But, you know, I feel like for some reason we've either found a way to try to use that to give ourselves this this guise of an edge, this sort of, you're masquerading as this what is it, like a progressive thinker, or you're masquerading as an activist. I think a lot of bands and people are talking the talk, but nobody's walking the walk. And as of recent, have been, you know, well, I mean, my whole life, but more so as of recent, because I think that I'm much more sage in my approach to be an, you know, an activist, is you know, I really want to explain what I think we have had done to us, and I want to explain what I think we should do about it, as opposed to just, you know, what usually comes off as maybe like a punk rock poet complaining. You know, with the last record, I'd certainly put myself in, you know, within the problems that I, you know, everything that I lamented, everything that I abhorred. With Black is Beautiful, I talked about everything from, you know, to sexuality to the political nature of certain things, and, you know, with healthcare and again, classism and things like that. But on this record, I've been more so honest and shed any veneer of the trend that I think is not necessarily the best approach to change. I don't think that a trend, you know, I don't think a hashtag is going to change everything. Right. I think it's a much bigger issue than these things that we're isolating, or these things that we think we're putting efforts into. Not to discredit what people are doing, because I love it. I love that we're more aware, and I love that we're more, you know, we're awake now, or we're waking up a little bit more in our in this era. But this record, to me, is certainly a call to the, you know, those that aren't ready to change, as just as much it is to the people that are ready. You know, I want to offer a place where people can learn and understand and see why this is not absent your interest. Like, this is your interest. This is in your interest to pay attention to these things, whether we want to live day by day. And even if you want to live in the now will also be in 20 years. You'll be living in the now 20 years from now. And then your now right. then will be fucked, you know, if you don't pay attention to what's happening right now. So, these are things, I mean, this is all, you know, all the way from like heteronormative presumption to, like I said, like systemic racism, you know, to an emotional disposition because of these things. And that's things that I've experienced as of recent. You know, I've been trying to learn who I am as a person emotionally and intellectually. And throughout the years, I think I'm getting somewhat of a grasp on it. And I've tackled that. If we're, you know, if we have any reason, as you and I, you know, you and I as poets, as writers, as artists, if there's anything we're supposed to do, I think it's we're supposed to discuss things emotionally, and we're supposed to show, you know, show these effects and how these interests are, you know, a part of everyone. I think that's what we do.
Totally.
I think.
Totally. Well, I'm interested in that a little bit too, because, you know, I know you just got recently married. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
I know, it's a beautiful thing. And I know, you know, before that, you've mentioned in like other interviews and stuff, and that you kind of had trouble with relationships, and you kind of felt like you were, you know, almost loveless in some ways.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wonder if now you kind of finally found this like deep love that you've sort of been searching for for a long time. And now you have this record, like, were you tempted to just write fucking love songs?
Yeah, dude, I did. I mean, like, honestly, like, I was writing. Okay, so that's a great question. Here's the funny thing and the fucking contradiction that is me writing a love song. So I'll write things in E flat, you know, and I'll like try to be, you know, still hopeful in my melodies, but still dark, you know? So I choose E flat, and I play these progressions that are classically, you know, romantic, and I sing romantically, but every fucking word that comes out of my mouth is how I need help being a romantic. It's like all the excess of who I was still needs to be shed. So I'm still shedding that in this record, and I'm still being honest about who I am, and I'm still finding traits of who I was in who I am now that I want to either omit from my existence, or I want to get better at. And I guess I'm still talking about, you know, the difficulties that I have had and that I currently have, but I'm looking at it through a less fearful lens. So I'm able to actually say more. Like I think I can say even more now because I have my wife, you know, who will back me, and my wife that will tell me,
yeah,
you're being an idiot or you're being beautiful. Like she'll shoot me straight, you know, and she'll always keep me where I need to be. And that is something I'm extremely thankful of. And she has taught me so many things about myself that I never, ever, ever wanted to confront. She has taught me, and I'm still learning. I mean, before we left, I don't want to air out our dirty laundry, baby, but like before I left on this tour, you know, I lost my mind. I got really, you know, cause I, because of what we talked about earlier, I come from a adverse background, and, I, you know, we were quite, violent in our change where I'm from, you know, if we wanted something, we took it kind of thing. And yeah. so those tendencies do still exist and reside within me. And I acted a way that I've never acted in front of her or wanted to. And I know that in the beginning, it sort of frightened her, you know, not towards her by any means. It was actually towards someone else. But in that, I was so angry that my aggressiveness, bellicose nature was certainly, you know, trickled over to her and made her uncomfortable. And that's,
yeah,
that made me feel horrible. And so she is such, you know, a beautiful person and soul that, you know, after a few minutes and after us talking, she, you know, she let me know it was all right and explained to me, you know, she's here to help me.
Right.
These things. So,
well, there's always things you're going to go through in a marriage, and, you know, you're going to, especially early on when you're going to learn about, you know, each other and yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you have to realize that you have to go to some of those dark places to ultimately be happy and be better.
Absolutely.
So I totally get it. But I mean, she's, yeah, you know, for the people that don't know, her name is Jin Wigmore, right?
Yep.
And she is also a professional musician, lead singer.
Yeah.
What's it like to be dating and now married to another lead singer when that's also what you do?
Yeah, it's awesome, man. It's ever inspiring. I mean, like, we understand each other quite well. And, you know, I think the only thing that makes it difficult, which is funny because it's ambivalence, because we get it. We totally understand where we're coming from, but because we're both doing it, it's so often that we're leaving or that we're doing interviews or that we have to deal with merch or we have to, like, cause she's extremely hands on. Like, she's DIY without even knowing what punk is. Like, she's just like super like about it. So like, yeah, we, I think that like, it's, I guess it's the best it could be in any relationship for me, at least as a musician that travels and a musician that makes this a career, that we understand each other. And even when we're,
right,
you know, have to take time away from being together, we understand that it's what it is. But we also, you know, since we do know that, we make it a huge point to, you know, go the extra mile. Like when I get home, so she was on tour and then she was home for a week and a half. And then I left on this tour and then she leaves next week while I'm still on tour. And then I arrive home and she's gone. So I'm going to fly to New Zealand and Australia and I'm going to do merch for her, you know, just so I can be on the tour, you know, and I can be with my wife. So,
yeah.
It's amazing.
That'll be different for you back on the table.
Yeah. It'll be crazy. Dude, I haven't done it in years. That'd be really cool. And, you know, I got home the other day and she was, she was trying to make a piano cover rendition of Black Hole Sun by Soundgarden. So it made me like want to do something, you know? So it's really inspiring at the same time. It's really cool.
That's cool. So I mean, I know you haven't been, you know, married for like a long time, but I guess you guys have been living together and stuff, but is it ever hard to separate that? Like that, okay, we're working, we're musicians, like I got this melody in my head, I'm working on it till like when, okay, let's just like go have dinner and not like talk about music. It does also your job, as you know. Is that ever hard to separate that?
Yeah, sometimes it is at right now, I think, because we're both at such pivotal points in our careers. I mean, she's done very well for herself as far as, you know, the international success that she's seen. And she came over here actually, you know, before we were dating, you know, a few years ago to do music in the States, like to have a presence here. So she's been doing really well. And then, you know, with that comes, of course, the inherent work that she has to do. And since she's so hands-on, she is like across all of it. And then I, obviously, with Let Live, I've also been writing a bunch of music on my own with someone, like a, kind of like another project, a solo project. And I've also got this company that I started with friends. Like, all these things are happening at once. And they just, you know, at this point, I think we're kind of realizing that very soon we're going to have to make a conscious decision to cut it off and just to stop bringing it into our personal life. But right now I do think we both understand that we need to feed into that in order to be successful so that we can have that time off, and it just sort of, these things eventually start running themselves.
Absolutely. No, that's great, man. That's a beautiful thing. So I guess I should ask you, you know, you said she's not punk rock, like I guess she grew up in a different way, but what does she think about you, like, getting up on stage? I mean, I don't know how many people have not seen Let Live perform. And I mean, every single time, and I've seen your band play probably at least, I mean, probably close to 50 times.
Yeah.
Every single show, you find a way to not only do something crazy, but always something different. And I'm sure almost every show, something wild happens. And I'm just wondering what your wife thinks about that. And is she scared you're going to hurt yourself?
Okay, so she does, she admits to me, she thinks that the performance is captivating. She does admit that she thinks it's certainly, you know, I guess something of an inimitable sort of scenario when I'm on stage. But I recently, or like 2 years ago, I did something really stupid, and I ended up having to get surgery on my hand during the Every Time I Die Code Orange Kids tour.
What did you do?
I ended up with my hand through a window, and the window was and the window was really like a really thick pane window. So I was somewhere else in my mind. I don't know how I got the strength or the fucking idiocy to put my hand in this window, but I did. And when I pulled my hand out, I had glass in my arm, and I was so adrenaline riddled, and you know, like I was doing it, whatever.
Yeah.
We were just about like, I got on stage, and I was bleeding really bad, really bad. And, I got my shirt, or my TM gave me a shirt, and I wrapped it on my, and we finished the song. And then the guys started jamming, the beginning of Mother. I remember this really well, actually, the beginning of the Mother. And, they had already, like, there was an ambulance by or something. Oh no, we started playing, and then an ambulance came, and then they did like a jam in the middle of Mother, and then I walked off stage, and they were like, okay, blah, blah, blah. They're talking to me. I was like, hey, I understand what you got to do right now, but I'm playing a show. Like, I'm currently on stage. And they were like, well, you have to leave. I was like, no, I need to finish my show. So what you need to do for me is make sure that this doesn't bleed out so I can finish, and then we will continue what we need to do. But at that point, apparently there's a code that they have to follow. And they're like, look, we need you to sign this and say that you refuse care and all this stuff. And I was like, okay, cool, whatever. And so I signed the thing, I refuse care. And then apparently when I signed that, after they had like wrapped me up in some shirt shit, they left. So I you know, I continued to play, and I started to feel my hand get really stiff. Like I couldn't move my hand, and it was really strange. But then following, you know, the next song was Fix Me. So I had to fucking, like, I wanted to play that song. So we played the song. It was also a show in Lubbock, Texas, and, Rotting Out, my buddies, like from home, like my OG homies. Who I hadn't seen in a long time, were on the show. So I was like, I'm not leaving the show. Like, it's going to be fun. We're about to, like, Fix Me. Benji from Running Out, Walter from Running Out, they were there. They were fucking stage diving. I was like, no, this is it. I want to do this. Finished the set, got off stage, and I was just chalk white. Like, you know, I'm a pretty tan guy having a black father. And I was really, 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 really pale. I looked like whiter than my mom. And so I asked for some Oreos, and I ate some Oreos for my blood sugar, and I got taken to the hospital by my good friend Scott Mackwater, who takes photos of us. And I walk in, and long story short, you know, after fucking getting admitted, after showing the wound, getting admitted immediately into the surgeon, he brings back an X-ray and he says, "Okay, so that thing, because I thought I had broken my arm and that it was like fucked up my nerves or my tendons so that I couldn't flex my hand." He was like, "Okay, so that thing you think is a bone that's popping, because it was popping out of my arm." I was like, yeah, what is it? And he's like, "Oh, that's a piece of glass that went in through the bottom and out to the top of your arm. So it has completely severed my flexor and my flexor tendon and my median nerve." So, I had to go into surgery that night and with no health insurance. So,
Oh, my God.
You know, so I lied. And I don't even know if I'm supposed to say that publicly, but I lied and I had, you know, a $35,000 surgery done for free because I needed my hand. And so now I've got, you know, I've got a trainer at home who's actually an old friend of mine who's helping me work with my mobility on my hand. And I've lost feeling in like a couple of my fingers, but I can still use my hand. I can still play guitar. I can still, play drums. Man. Yeah. So,
does your band ever like, dude, we know like this is what you do. We know you go crazy, but like if something happens to you, we have to cancel the fucking tour. Like, that's going to really suck. Like, is that ever a conversation you guys have?
No, they've never, never. My band, like sometimes I'm like, I wonder if my band gives a fuck about that. Cause like,
they do.
It's a fine line.
Cause they don't want to be like, they don't want to say, "Look, Jason, we're worried," because they still want you.
No,
but
totally.
They must be. I mean, I've had conversations with members of your band when you weren't around.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of like, "Yep, that's Jason being Jason." And, hopefully he doesn't fuck himself up too bad, you know?
Totally. Yeah. That's what I mean. It's like, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. Because seriously, so I did that. It was the first time I'd ever had like that kind of surgery, like a microsurgery. It was the first time. And I woke up, and I guess I had a really bad reaction to something in the surgery. And they were like, I heard them trying to wake me up, but I was like in that weird state of paralysis where I could hear everything, but I couldn't open my eyes and shit. Like, so they were trying to wake me up after the surgery because I guess I broke out this crazy sweats and I was like all crazy. And I woke up and I was basically naked. Like when I woke up, they'd taken my fucking gown off me and like they had all this water around me and it was really weird. And, I woke up and I don't usually, if I go to like the dentist or doctors and I refuse anesthetic. I don't really like that stuff because of prior, issues with it as a kid. And they had me on this fucking crazy, this fucking crazy ass anesthetic. So I was like, I was fucked up that night. And, I remember my guitar player, Jeff, and my tour manager, Richard, being in the room with me, like, which was super gangster. Like just, they were there and which was so dope. And they sat with me, they brought me food. Like it was super cool. And I was all loopy. And then I remember going, "All right, like we can get out of here and I'll play the show." And they're like, "I don't think that's going to happen." I was like, no, it's good. I was all fucked up. I was like, "No, I'm good. Like whatever." And I tried to get up and I started, vomiting and shit. I was like really sick. And then, they wouldn't actually like let me leave the hospital and, like neither my tour manager or guitar player or the hospital. So, but the next day, I woke up and we drove and we played the rest of the tour. So I'm, I make sure that, I don't want to impose my fucking imbecilic ways on the rest of my band, so I made sure to finish the tour, even though it was like pretty painful.
Well, my next question is, how many venues, have you been kicked out and or banned from?
Dude, I don't know, man. A lot. Like, like a lot. I couldn't even tell you.
Any notable ones? Any famous ones?
The Key Club, which was like, a thing back in Hollywood back in the day. The Knitting Factory in Boise and in LA, we had a really, really, embarrassing story with the Key Club of LA, when we were much more ragtag of a group. And fuck, dude, we've been kicked out of a bunch or like banned from, or like, I mean, this one, dude, the one I'm at right now, actually, fuck, the one I'm at right now, they told me we'd never come back, and like, I'm sitting here now, so.
You guys are at Egyptian Room, right?
Yeah. The first time I came here, they were like, they're
well, sometimes we've been banned from a few too, and I find if you come in, like, well, if you come in as a headliner, they're not going to cancel the fucking show.
Mm-hmm.
And if you come in on an opener, usually you can kind of sneak on. You know, they don't
notice. Yeah, exactly.
Contracts are signed or whatever. So
totally,
I think you'll
be
all right.
Yeah.
Do you ever have, like, with the crazy shit you pulled, do you ever have, like, headlining bands, tour managers or ever being like, dude, you're like, this isn't cool?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like, dude, are bands ever, like, pissed, like, feeling like you're fucking upstaging them and shit? Like, is that ever a conversation?
Yeah. It's happened a couple times, but to be 100% honest, it would be totally disingenuous and unauthentic to me as a person to water it down or to, like, to curb my performance. Like, that's not what, like, why would I do it? Why would I even be here if I was, you know, not
me? Yeah, but I mean, it's crazy because, like, the first time I saw you play, we were on tour together, and I was like, this guy must be just, like, fucked up on drugs or, like, I don't even know what the hell he's doing. But you're, like, a straight-edge dude.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah.
There's no substances in you. You're, like, you're good. And what comes over you? You just get up there and you just, like, black out and you just don't even know what's going on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that all of us is for the most part, as a sentient and frontal lobe, you know, emotional being.
Oh, you're getting very technical. Oh, and
you
emotional.
You know me.
Okay,
you know me. I mean, I just feel like we there's a lot of things that we don't get to experience because of, again, the social constructs and or ideas of, like I said, like what is right and wrong and what is acceptable in everyday life. And for me, like, I want to experience most of those things. Again, speaking of the fact that I subscribe to, like, a straight edge lifestyle, those are the things that I have staved off of because I think that because of my already low inhibitions, if I were to do those things, if I lowered my inhibitions even more, it would probably not be a good idea. You know, like, I probably wouldn't have the self-control when I'm not on stage, you know, to be reasonable, you know, to be like, I'd be insufferable. I think people would not like being around me. So,
My friend wanted to ask you this. So it's not my question; it's my friend's question.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, ask him if, like, when he goes into the venue, he starts, like, looking around and being like, am I going to jump off this? Am I going to grab this? Like, does that happen? Or is it just like, you're up there and you're like, oh shit, I see that. I'm going to go do it. And how many times are you like, no, cause I'm probably going to die. Like, what goes through your head?
I never ever like scan the venue because I feel like it'll like look contrived. It'll look like I was, you know what I'm saying? Like, not to mention if I do it in the moment, it's more exciting. You know, I'm like, oh dude, I didn't even know that was there. Like, then it actually, like, sort of gives me a boost of adrenaline to go and get up to something or jump off of something or fail something. But, you know what, dude, I think that's my problem is, not really having that gauge, when you're there, me being like, maybe not, like, I don't really have that gauge. And I didn't have that gauge very much in skateboarding either. Like, or, sports anything, you know, I never was like, maybe not. Like, I was always like, okay, you kickflip the 7, why don't you go and kickflip the 11 at, you know, down the street? Yeah, okay, cool, and do it. Oh, you kickflip the 11, like, go do the 15, like, things like that. Like, I just feel like once you've done one thing, you can probably do the next. Like, I just want to believe in the unknown, you know. I want to believe in, like, this, like, fucking highfalutin idea of limitless, that could be a bit dangerous, but I don't know, man, I've been all right so far, and
I have two Jason Butler stories I want to share really quick, and then I want you to tell me your favorite. But my two favorites are the one time we were playing in White Rabbit in San Antonio, which is a fucking classic place, and you lost your mind, and I think there was a beer, and you smashed the bottle on the stage, took off your shirt, maybe your shirt was already off, rolled around in the glass, and then I think you put the glass in your mouth,
oh yeah,
and
yeah.
you were. Your tongue was bleeding, and you're bleeding about the mouth pretty bad. And then I was like, Jason, did you swallow any glass? And you're like, a little bit, I think.
Oh, no.
That's one of my favorites. And then the other one, when which is funny because I'm in my apartment right now in Toronto, and I can look out and I can actually see where it happened because I live right on the lake here in Toronto. And it was at the Warped Tour. And I don't know if you remember this, but you left the stage. I think you picked some flowers for a girl first, and then which was very cute. And then you climbed some like tower and you found like a boat.
Oh yeah,
like
raft.
An inflatable boat or a raft. Yeah, yeah, and then you got up on it. I was like, how the fuck, like,
dude? That was serendipity. I got lucky. Like, I just got lucky that I was there.
Oh, yeah, because that was my friend. He saw that. That's right. Because it was my best friend that was with me at that show. And I was like, you got to check out this band. And he's like, I think he knew the boat was up there. I was like, I don't think so, man. I think it just happened.
Dude, I just got lucky, man. Because, I mean, obviously, I didn't hop in there before the set. You know, like, I mean, I usually don't even go to stage before we play unless you guys were
right.
playing.
Oh yeah, no, I knew. I told him. I was like, no, man, I don't think so. And he's like, I don't know. That's a little too perfect of a storm.
I know, seriously. Just got lucky, dude. Just got lucky.
Do you have a favorite one after all these years?
Fuck, man. I don't know. I mean, that year, dude, that was so much fun. That Warped Tour year was so much fun, like with you guys and Amity and Architects and all of our friends were like, it was so much fun. I think my favorite would have to just be this now because I'm married to this woman is when I in Camden, New Jersey, I got off stage and I only know this. I really know this because Jin told me the story and then there's a video of it that I sent to Joel from Amity. Joel and some of the homies were like, the Monster stage, if you remember that day, there was like a hillside next to us in that stage. And, people were like sitting because it was like where you could walk to the buses. And all the homies were sitting watching us play that day on that hillside. And I walked up, I took, because we had to kind of make our own stage for Warped Tour because we put a hole in the stage the first day. And so I took the board of wood that we had makeshift stage for us. And I brought the plywood thing with carpets. And I brought it up the side of the hill. And I asked Joel to hold it for me. And then I said, all right, now when I say go, I need you to let it go. And he's like, what? And I said, yeah, just let it go. And as I'm doing all of this, Jen Wigmore, like my soon-to-be wife, is stopped because she's going to her bus. And she's stopped by this crowd of security and an idiot with a big board of wood trying to slide down the side of a mountain. And she stopped and she told me that she's like, who is this asshole who's just tearing apart like a stage? And like, I'm just trying to go get my dinner. And I said, all right, Joel, go. And he let it go. And I slid down the side of this mountain on this, this board of wood. And I remember boom, hitting the ground and looking up and seeing Jin and being like, oh fuck, that's that really pretty, really awesome voice girl that is on this tour. And I just remember kind of being like, should I like make a note? Should I say something? I said, nah, and I got up left. But, and now I'm married.
You played
her.
It cool, man. You played it
cool.
Yeah,
you know, your boy, I gotta be blasé. Yeah. So I think that'd be my favorite just cause like, then we ended up getting married, you know, going from like the dude who she thought was completely like reckless and just pretty much a brat, you know, now we're married. So.
I love it, man. Well, dude, I won't take up any more of your time, but it's really great talking to you, catching up, and sharing some old stories.
Thank you, man.
All the best on tour.
You too, bro.
We'll talk soon.
You, my man. Thank you so much. This is rad. Thanks, Shane.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
All right.
And there it is. My friend Jason is doing well, as always. He was filling in for Every Time I Die, which is crazy. I wish I could have asked him about that, but we recorded this right before that happened. So that must have been crazy for him as well. I'm sure we'll do a part two. We did over an hour there, and I feel like, again, we didn't even scratch the surface of all the things we could have talked about. So, terrific guy, and it's really great to see him doing so well with his marriage and everything. And I can't wait for a new Let Live record. Next week, another all-new episode. Who knows who it'll be? You never know. And we got a few lined up. I don't even know what we're going to do yet, but it's going to be a doozy, as always. Thanks again. We'll see you next week. Happy New Year. Peace and love. As has become tradition on this podcast, I will leave you with a Let Live tune. This is from their 2010 release, Fake History. The song is called Mother.